this is Lewis.
And this is Ian.
And welcome to 101 Films You Should Have Seen.
Probably.
Right, straight in that time. That was really good.
Yeah, stop drawing attention to it.
So this week, it's one of Ian's recommendations.
It is indeed, yeah. We should probably explain the circumstances of recording this. We had a slightly rushed podcast of film watching experience this week. Through various circumstances, both me and Liz have been quite busy, and we've had to watch the film tonight just before we record it, something we've never done before. Normally we
it's almost live.
Yeah, it almost is. Normally we watch the film, ponder it, consider it, allow it to digest in our film tummies, and then come up with, as you would have told from our previous podcast, reasoned arguments, well thought out points.
You can expect none of that tonight. Yeah. None of that.
So sadly, all that kind of professionalism that you come to expect from 101 Films is going to be perhaps slightly lacking tonight as we go fly by the seat of our pants.
This is unknown territory.
Well, today we're going to be talking about one of my recommendations, as Lewis said, The Day the Earth Caught Fire, a 1961 British film.
Not to be confused with The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is wholly more dull. It's just about everyone stopping.
Well, yeah, a science fiction classic.
But, I've not seen it, but I believe
really?
That's the... I've seen the Keanu Reeves remake.
I was just about to ask you that. Have you seen the Keanu Reeves remake?
Well, it's tarnished it for me.
Oh, no, it's well, The Day the Earth Caught Still. It's a little bit slow, but it's well worth a watch. But anyway, The Day the Earth Caught Fire. Now... this is actually one of my favourite films, I'd say, for various reasons. I caught it at a very impressionable age. I think the first time I saw it, I must have been about 10 or 11 years old. And it had quite an impact on me. I think just its depiction of a kind of a very British apocalypse, which we'll talk about in a bit. And you know, and there's elements of it which I just found absolutely fascinating. And since then, it was one of those films I kind of saw when I was quite young. I was like, oh, yeah. And then, I suppose, similar to you and Zardoz, you were a bit, you know, as you got a bit older, like, what was that film? What was that film about? And I remember talking to my dad about it. He said, oh, yeah, it was really good. And, you know, he really enjoyed it. And then, randomly, when I was living in Brighton, my girlfriend at the time just said, oh, do you fancy going to the cinema? Apparently, we used to live close to one of the... oh, what's the chain of slightly art housey picture houses?
And
the picture house in Brighton. Oh, the name escapes me. But we lived a close time. And she said, oh, do you want to fancy watching this film? It's supposed to be very good. And it was The Day the Earth Caught Fire. And I was very surprised. I didn't realise it was quite as popular as that. And went along expecting that me and her would be the only two watching it. And the entire place was absolutely packed. So I think it's actually a film that's has a cult following, has a certain, you know, people, film buffs or people who are into British films certainly have heard about it. And I think it's kind of growing in popularity, or people are knowing about it a bit more because of its subject matter. And, well, to explain, to the pitch, I'm not going to claim ownership of this of this pitch myself. I did read this somewhere, but I thought it was a really neat summing up. And even though I haven't seen the film where this reference is taken from, I kind of understand what they mean. It was His Girl Friday, but with the world ending.
That's quite apt. I was essentially watching it thinking, oh yeah, it really reminds you of His Girl Friday.
So it's about a journalist who uncovers... it's a slightly ludicrous plot, I guess, to modern ears. The idea is that the Russians and the Americans, detonate at the same time two massive nuclear weapons, these massive nuclear weapons, and the resultant explosions knock the Earth off its axis and plunge the Earth hurtling towards the sun. And the film is about a journalist who works for the Daily Express, played by Edward Judd, Peter Stenning, and... it's all about him uncovering the plot, really, uncovering the story. And it's not, I suppose, a modern apocalypse film, which you would think of things like or The Day After Tomorrow or...
it's an awful...
Godzilla, things like that, where it's just, you know, action and the concept of... It's more of a... It's interesting because I think it shows an apocalypse very, as it would, a slow, steady decline of things just gradually getting worse and worse and things deteriorating.
Yeah, it's interesting because it focuses really on the minutiae of daily life and how things are affected, whereas something like the Day After Tomorrow is just focused solely on massive special effects and, tidal waves wiping out New York and all that kind of stuff. In this film, it's very much, how does it affect the little people? And you kind of see, I think it's been described as kind of a cinema verite style where it's just focusing in on kind of daily events. And it's much more affecting because of that,
Yeah, I think you can equate so much more for it. Whereas I suppose the kind of modern apocalypse flick, and it has become its own kind of genre now, hasn't it? There's been so many over the last few years. But most of them tend to concentrate on, you'll see it's all about from the president's and the general's point of view.
Yeah.
It's, you'll have your everyman there, but, he normally will have a connection to the president in some way.
Exactly.
Or he'll have some kind of, he may be the everyman, but within halfway through the film, he's there in the Oval Office going, Mr. President, if you don't do this, the world is doomed. And it also, all those films tend to show the authorities in quite a good light. Whereas this film is all about people, as you say, reacting to the authorities. The authorities not giving the full truth. The authorities making decisions without people really knowing what's going on, why they're making those decisions. Mm. And then just kind of getting on with it and putting out with it.
Oh, it's interesting. I was really expecting, I've seen quite a few kind of 50s and 60s sci-fi films, so I was expecting something kind of very similar. Lots of creaky special effects and, cheesy dialogue and scientists, coming to the rescue and all that kind of stuff, but it's not at all like that.
No, I personally think the pace of it's very slow and steady, but otherwise, like, the dialogue is so fast.
Very fast. That's immediately what reminded me of His Girl Friday. Have you seen His Girl Friday?
No, I haven't. No. It's on our list, I think. It's what we're going to do.
We might have to do that one next.
Yeah.
But it's incredibly fast. You really have to pay attention.
Yeah, really. I remember the first time I watched it. Not the first time, because the first time I saw it when I was a kid. But when I saw it at the cinema, I really had to concentrate quite hard to understand everything what they were saying, because it just shows newsroom banter, and there's no pauses, there's no wait. It's just like ba 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 ba, and like between like four or five different characters, it's like bang bang bang, like machine gun style dialogue just being fired out constantly.
Totally, blink and you'll miss it.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, I kind of, when I saw it that second time for the first time since I was a kid, I kind of did warn, my girlfriend, when I saw it with her, I just go, well, remember, it's a 1950s British film. It'll probably be quite slow. Mm. Yeah, I remember it being quite good. And we won't spoil it, but, great, great ending. And but when we were in there, I didn't feel like that at all. And it whips, to me, goes very, very quickly, gets to the meat of the story very, very quickly, doesn't faff around too much.
Yeah.
And
fantastic opening scene.
Yes.
Really good opening scene. It's kind of, you can see where 28 Days Later kind of got its ideas for this kind of deserted London, and the main character just kind of stumbling through it, and then starts his story, and that's when the film really begins. It flips back to 3 months previously.
Yeah, and it sort of shows you how they got there. And what a great little touch is the orange filter on it.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously a black and white film, but they use this kind of orange filter or tint to the colour, and just to give it that kind of feel of heat and literally the earth on fire.
Yeah, no, it's really good. I was very impressed with this film, definitely.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Oh, that's good. After some of their albums.
Godfather. What was that all about? Jeez.
Well, I was slightly worried, actually, showing you this one, because when there is something that you really like, and I suppose, now when I was thinking about showing you this, especially considering the circumstances, we were going to watch it as well, because I knew it was going to be a bit rushed, and I was like, this is bad, and then I thought, well, I can't really complain, seeing how horrible I was about Black Cat White. So, this is karma, I guess. So, very quick, I mean, really, there's not a huge cast to the film. Well, there's lots of supporting characters, but I suppose there's kind of really four main characters, or four people who seem to have the most dialogue in the film. You have Edward Judd, who I've always already mentioned as Peter Stenning. He's a real kind of square-jawed.
He's not your typical hero, though. He's got his failings.
Yeah, kind of has been recently divorced. a bit of an alcoholic, or on the way to become an alcoholic. You know, things are sort of falling apart for him. He's kind of got his partner in crime, or his mate in the newsroom, Bill Maguire, as played by Leo McKern.
Leo McKern's great, isn't and, he? Well, as soon as I saw him, I was like, it's Rumpole!
Yeah, I was going to say, just those at home, you may not know who Leo McKern is. He's a fine British actor who... most famous, I suppose, in the UK anyway, for playing Rumpole of the Bailey on television. Janet Monro as Jeannie Craig, as the love interest.
The lovely Jeannie.
The lovely Jeannie Craig. She is lovely, though, isn't she?
She is lovely.
She is absolutely great in this.
All lovely and black and white.
Yeah, but very... Alright, well, we'll talk about that a bit.
Oh, something saucy. Should we talk about it after the podcast?
Yeah. When... 101 Films Blue.
We'll do our sexy special.
The sexy spin-off. And even though I suppose he's not really one of the main characters, but I just love him. Arthur Christensen as the editor.
Yeah.
Now, Arthur Christensen was actually the editor of
The Daily Express.
Not at the time. He'd left like a few years before. And as far as I can tell, this was his only... acting role.
I think so, yeah. I had a quick look on IMDb. I think he played a minor role in something else after this, but yeah, there's pretty much, he's just an editor playing an editor.
And there are moments where he does it quite well, and there are other moments where, if you've seen Dark Place, he's it's like Dean Lerner, played by Richard Adiola.
Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, yeah.
it's really like, da-da-da-da. And I wonder if Richard Adiola kind of got based him on that. Because there are moments where it's really, really similar. And I know it's actually in the film, there's a couple of moments where he fluffs his lines, where he makes mistakes, and they just kind of brush over it.
Yeah, he's flicking their switches. Get everyone in for a conference. I want everyone in here now for a conference.
Yeah, well, the moment I always found quite affecting is where they find out that the world is going to come to an end, that the Earth is definitely ending.
Yeah,
and he kind of has the big kind of conference with everyone, telling them what they're going to report, and then all the characters goes, "All right, everyone, go," and they all run out, and he just picks up the phone and he goes, "Could you get me my wife?" And that it's his secretary, and that's it. And he sort of takes his glasses off as if that's, you know, things sort of coming to an end.
Yeah, that was a very impressive scene, actually. Surprisingly moving.
Yeah. Right, before we move on, shall we do our trivia quiz?
Ooh, you know I love the trivia.
Trivia quiz with our special new jingle.
Did you like the jingle, by the way?
But we'll have it for now.
Oh well, maybe you can record.
Oh, maybe I will. Perhaps we'll have a jingle off. Jingle. A jingle off. We'll play with each other's jingles. That sounds totally.
Okay, so insert the jingle now.
Trivia. 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 And you just spat all over the computer.
Oh dear,
I?
Sorry about that. That was a bit green.
Oh great. That's even better. Right. So, quiz. Okay. Do you want to go first or shall I?
You go first because I'm not quite ready.
God. Are you sure you want me to go first? Because I've got like 5 questions just in case, because I thought you might go for some obvious ones.
Okay, all right.
Just in
case. I've got some brilliant questions.
Okay, good.
Okay, so most of these questions center around Liam McKern.
Oh no. Alright, okay.
Okay, so Leo McKern has a glass eye.
He does.
But which of these celebrities didn't have a glass eye?
Okay.
Sammy Davis Jr.
Right.
Napoleon.
Right.
Peter Falk.
Yeah.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Ooh. I'll say Napoleon.
Okay. And in the film, Leo McKern has a great line where he says, "Get me the melting points. I want to know, points of steel and my glass eye or something like that."
Yeah.
So what has a lower melting point, steel or glass?
Oh, steel.
Okay. And finally, Leo McKern starred as Rumpole of the Bailey. But who wrote the Rumpole books?
Oh, John Mortimer.
Okay, that's it.
Okay, right, my questions. Oh, no, you didn't ask any of my questions, so that's good. All right, okay, first of all, the film won a BAFTA. Can you tell me what the BAFTA was for?
Oh, I'm going to guess special effects.
Okay. Now, the one, in many ways, one of the stars of the film is the Daily Express.
Yes.
It's great advertising for the Daily Express.
It is.
And you kind of watch that film and it makes you just depressed about what the Daily Express is quite as now and who owns the Daily Express now, Richard Desmond. But who owns the
What are you saying about Richard Desmond?
I'm saying he's a pornographer and a horrible person.
What about Channel 5?
Well, that's... Your Honour, I rest my case.
Celebrity Big Brother, come on! God.
Yeah, and the Daily Star just pushing it. Oh, anyway, who owned the Daily Express back then?
Oh, I think it was Lord Beaverbrook.
Right, okay. And finally, there are two links between this film and James Bond. Can right. you mention one of them?
Ah, well, I know one of them, and okay. that's the guy who wrote the music in this film, also wrote the theme tune to James Bond.
The James Bond theme.
The James Bond theme.
Yeah, okay.
Another link. Ooh. God, guess a link with James Bond. No. Oh, was it... were parts filmed in the Ministry of Defence? That's a complete guess.
Okay. Right, all right. All right, do you want to give the answers back?
Okay, so my Leo McKern trivia quiz.
Yes.
Leo McKern has a glass eye. Who doesn't have a glass eye? Napoleon, you're right.
Yeah, that's...
Okay. Lord Nelson had a glass eye.
Oh, okay.
I threw that in. I thought that might fool you there.
Do you know what I was going to say? I was going to say, yeah, because I just, in all his films, he doesn't have a glass eye. When I've seen Napoleon depicted on the film, I just imagined... it. Also, I just thought that would have made a big deal. Even now... we still have the idea of Napoleon being a shoe arse.
Yeah.
And that's because of British propaganda from then. And that's stuck with us ever since. So if exactly. he had a glass eye, they would have made a big deal out
yeah.
of that.
And of course, Napoleon in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure didn't have a glass eye. Exactly. Which is the definitive,
film screen, Napoleon. Silver screen version of Napoleon. Yeah. Napoleon.
I think we've already agreed on that. What is a lower melting point, steel or glass? Steel. Yes, you're right.
Yeah. I just because I know they use glass a lot. For like beakers and things like that in science. All about the science.
I mean, it is a little bit controversial because you do have different alloys and all that kind of stuff.
Of course,
so,
yeah.
But yeah, generally speaking, steel has a slightly lower melting point. And Rumpel of the Belly was written by John Mortimer.
Three out of three. I'm a Leo McKern.
Leo McKern genius.
Right. So my questions, the screenplay for now I've given the answer away. The film won BAFTA for the best screenplay.
Not special effects.
Oh, no.
Some of them were quite good.
Some of them weren't bad, especially for the time. Subtly used. I feel. The proprietor of the Daily Express at the time was Lord Beaverbrook.
Yes.
So well done, and. The two links, you got one, so you got a point there. It was that his name was Monty Norman, and he wrote the theme tune to James Bond, and he wrote some beatnik music. I think it was the sequence where the teens are on the rampage.
Teen rampage!
And I think he wrote the beatnik music for that.
Okay.
The other connection is, of course, Val Guest. He directed some of Casino Royale, the debacle that was Casino Royale.
Oh, no way.
And he did, once he saw the finished product, well, he basically did recorded big chunks of it, and he was asked to kind of provide some linking sequences and try and sort of knock the film into some kind of shape. And once he saw the finished product, he did ask his name to be taken off.
Really?
They just said no. We're going to use you. Because at the time, Val Guest, and I'll talk about Val Guest, well, I might as well talk about him now. Val Guest was quite a well-respected director. He directed, obviously, The Day the Earth Caught Fire, which did quite well. He also directed the first two Quatermass films.
Yeah, The Quatermass Experiment. I've not seen that one. Is that good?
Oh, The Quatermass Experiment, yeah. I would say Quatermass in the Pit, the... second one is, I think that's the second one, or is that the third? I know it's the third TV show. Anyway, whatever, and maybe he did direct that one. Who knows?
Dear.
Whatever, it's they're good. So the first Quatermass is a really good film, but okay. Yeah, better than the TV series, simply because the TV series is painfully posh and slow, because it was one of the earliest kind of TV shows ever made.
They only allowed posh people on TV in the
1950s. Oh, the voice. Like one of the women in the TV series literally speaks She's posh than the Queen. It's incredible. And to go on a slight tangent, that's one actually, because it's really interesting to watch the TV shows, Queen of Mass Experiment, and then the third one, Queen of Mass the Pit. They were made about 6 years apart, but the difference in production values and just the televisual language, it feels like it's over 20 years apart. They go from very stagey, almost like theatre, in Queen of Mass Experiment, to pretty modern, sharp, quite quick-moving television by like the end of the 50s.
People weren't dazzled by moving images.
It's incredible, just the change. Yeah, it really shows you how quickly things developed. Yeah, it really is. Anyway,
we should do Quake Mess in the Pit at some point.
Yeah, maybe we will, yeah. We're doing quite a lot of these. I don't want to do too many black and white science fiction versions.
I did actually know, so we're quite sci-fi heavy on our list of films.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I thought maybe we'll have to focus on a few others. Well, we did Godfather last time.
That's true. Listeners, write in with some more films for us to watch that aren't sci-fi, British sci-fi films.
Unfortunately, I think when we've asked for recommendations, obviously the kind of people who are going to put up with two idiots rambling, the kind of people who can put up with perhaps some slightly poor special effects and things like that. They can oversee that sort of stuff and enjoy kind of... Basically, what I'm saying is the kind of people who can enjoy rubbish films enjoy us, because we are rubbish. So.
Oh, it's nice to know we've got kindred spirits out there.
Yeah, well, you know. So, Val Guest, actually. I think the direction Val Guest brings to the film, it's fantastic. I think he's really good.
Really good.
Some really nice little touches as well. As we were saying earlier, how the film very much is a depiction of the kind of real effects of an apocalypse, and just like those little things, like
I like the way the British queued all the way through the apocalypse.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the queuing. Just showing. You know, it's like the Thames slowly disappearing as it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. Just like sort of lots of what's the phrase? Is it matte?
Yeah, matte paintings.
Paintings in the background. Like, you saw like Richmond Park, Hyde Park, sorry, just like a complete barren, parched wasteland. And
Nottingham Forest on fire.
Yeah, things like that. I just noticed when they're doing, there's that bit where like they've got those kind of speakers and they're sort of saying, an important announcement from the Prime Minister tonight. And you see one from Trafalgar Square, and then you just know, just underneath, I just noticed they just like had a dead pigeon just lying there. Just little things like that to kind of...
Yeah.
And, you know, the cars all having those kind of gas...
Yeah, sort of. It started running on gas. I guess that must have been... That's quite close, I suppose, to the Second World War, when they must have had that same experience. You know?
Yeah.
They converted a lot of vehicles to gas.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. It would only have been... 15, 16 years since the Second World War, so pretty much everyone except the little children would have grown up or remembered or fought in the war or lived in London during the war. And yeah, I suppose that was an apocalyptic battle. It was probably felt that to those people there, and they just kind of got on with things. And as that poster that's become so widely overused, keep calm and carry on.
Yes, which wasn't even used then.
No, it wasn't. It was there in case of invasion, wasn't it? Yeah, but I think, and Valga, he keeps it moving really quickly as well. Mm. You know, really, the only thing I would say that does slightly date it is all the sequences, he repeats a lot of sequences in terms of like showing, the printing presses going and newspapers being delivered and, you know, films often just, whereas I think now films tend to just, you just know, you accept something's happening, you don't have to see all the processes. Films often had to show everything happening.
It was absolutely fascinating watching that whole printing sequence, though. It's a kind of historical thing, because that just doesn't happen now.
Well, it's a glimpse of Fleet Street, which has just disappeared.
That was really interesting. The idea that, you know, well, the fact that all the newspapers are on Fleet Street, which... Yeah. Isn't the case anymore.
And they all drunk in the same bars. That was it, because they go to like Harry's Bar, which is their bar next door, and they're all like, all the different journalists from all the different newspapers all kind of know each other and sort of banter with each other.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was reading is just saying, whatever you think of the film, it's actually now becoming just an interesting, as you say, really nice historical curio of just a snapshot of what journalism was like then, and printing presses and newspaper industry was like. And it does really feel like it's, yeah, it, that kind of the sense, yeah, the people write the stories above where the newspapers are being printed. And they all kind of know each other, you know, like a journalist will write something, he'll, someone will set it out and then it will be printed and there's a chain there, and they, the journalist who wrote it could literally walk down the stairs to the basement and then look at the printing presses and see his words coming off.
Yeah, it's craziness. I mean, I work in publishing, and just how much it's changed now. You can literally just, you know, send something, bam, it's published, done, you know, whereas just the sheer mechanicalness of the whole thing, having to set all of the letters and call people up and say, right, we need this and this. And yeah, it's just really interesting to kind of see that, how it's changed.
And the, yeah, like, oh,
boy, as well. Every time there's a new bit of copy, boy, send this to the printers.
What I love about that is the first boy you see is an old bald man, like, boy, and it's just a little old fella.
He shuffles up, takes the paper from his hand, probably grumbling on his tail. Boy, I'll give you boy.
So what do you
think? I need a boy in the office.
Yeah, everyone wants like just a boy now. They're like, boy, get me a Coke. And then just have a go at them when you just take out all your anger on them as well. When you're just, and then go, oh, sorry, sir, roll their eyes. They roll their eyes and go, oh, sorry, sir, and then walk off. You can just hilariously put them down in front of everyone and they just sort of shrug it off. Unless they get typhoid fever like the boy does.
Oh dear. Well, at least no one important got typhoid. Typhoid.
Yeah, that's the main thing.
That's the main thing.
So what do you feel the strongest bits of the film are?
Well, like I said, I think the bit where they got told the apocalypse was happening. I mean, that's quite a moving scene. I generally think the special effects were quite good as well. And I like the way that it kind of creates a sense of creeping menace with other news reports coming in from around the world of kind of floods and drought and all that kind of stuff. I think a particular scene, probably the weakest scene, I can tell you the weakest scene, which I felt was the kind of the riots.
Yeah, the beatniks.
Riots. Yeah. I mean, it suddenly turned into a Russ Meyer film.
That definitely has aged it, definitely. Yeah. That sequence really does feel very old-fashioned. Mm. I guess, what was it, 61 teenagers all brand new still, weren't they?
Yeah,
it is very much that, and sort of Edward Judd playing very much the old-fashioned establishment figure. Yeah, like...
just gonna bop you on the nose, young tyke.
Yeah, come on, you ruffians, out you go. I think that's just one of those things. Unfortunately, a film can't ever quite, any kind of film that depicts youth culture tends to age badly.
Totally.
As soon as it has, because it's generally sort of shown. Yeah, the youth culture shown in any film is normally about 5 or 6 years out of date. Yeah, all those youths in that thing are all, you know, playing on trumpets and things. Yeah, rock and roll had been around for a good like five, six years. Yeah, exactly. Elvis Presley had been about, and but none of them are like greasers. Yeah. None of them are wearing leather jackets.
Yeah, exactly. Just harmless young kids. I mean, in that scene, they were just trying to give that lady a bath, and he knocked one of them down a lift shaft. Yeah. I mean, come on, punishment to fit the crime, or what? And yet, that seemed to be perfectly fine. Try to give that lady a bath, and I'll knock you down this lift shaft.
Out on your ear.
I don't have that sort of thing in this country.
Yeah, no, I think I agree that is one of the weakest spots, but I think the strongest bit is what we sort of mentioned earlier, is because the film sort of drips feeds the how things are slightly unraveling. So earlier on, it's just a little about unusual weather, and they're trying to work out why the unusual weather's happening, and then the scientists and the government admit that the Earth has been sort of moved on its axis slightly. Mm-hmm. So that's going to change, you know, where the tropics are, where the Arctic regions are. So that explains what the wild weather is about. And then you get the scene where they realise that the explosions have actually not just knocked it off of its tilt, its axis. It's actually knocked it out of its orbit, and it's now on a orbit towards the sun. And just where they find that out. And just this little sort of touches. Mm. And I think actually, bless him, Arthur Christensen. Although, and he doesn't play himself. That's the funny thing. He plays Jeff Jefferson.
Yeah, Jeff Jefferson.
But
it sounds like something out of Spider-Man, doesn't it?
No, Jeff Jefferson. He does expect Peter Parker to rush in and go, Parker, go in.
J. Jonah Jameson. That's probably what it's based on.
Yeah,
as well.
Maybe.
Jeff Jefferson.
Jeff J. Jefferson. But when he sort of hears the news from his Russian correspondent that, you know, the Russians... Interesting, the Russians are the ones to tell the truth first.
Yeah.
Soviet Union are the ones to say that actually the world is in a decaying orbit. And, I think that whole sequence is really well done. They kind of find the news out and, he sort of looks out the window and sort of says, you've got family? And he goes, maybe you should get them out of the city. I don't think they'll be very pleasant places to live in soon. And just little things like that. And just a very British understatement of and as I say, that scene closing of just him asking to speak to his wife.
Yeah, I think, you know, in different actors' kind of mouths, that it could have been quite kind of twee, kind of crass dialogue, maybe a bit clichéd, but somehow it really, really works.
Yeah, his sheer awkwardness somehow sells.
Yeah. It's funny that.
I think another really good scene is his kind of is Pete's seduction of Jeannie, just where he sort of they get lost because of there's a heat mist created basically from all the water so being evaporated, and London is plunged into fog. So again, really interesting for us seeing, because they use what I think they do actually do well, slightly just on a tangent here. Valguest does quite well to tie in stock footage. Into the film and make it, and what interesting here, there's a couple of things where he shows stock footage and then he's filmed bits that kind of follow on from that stock footage. So there's a sequence where you see like a lady, I think it looks like in France, wading through a flood, which is obviously stock footage, and then he cuts and he's dressing up like the old lady, you just sort of see her feet carrying the same stuff, and then he's got one of the newspaper on the floor with a headline showing what's going on. So he ties in all that stock footage quite well. And in that fog sequence, you see lots of stock footage of like the great fogs that London used to have,
which apparently most Americans seem to think we still have.
It's so true. Like when I was in Vancouver, we had like a week of really bad fog. A fog I've never seen anything like it. You know, now anyway, you get fog for like a morning. It's very rarely long. You don't really get fog for longer than a day, do you? We had fog for like all week, just coming in off the coast, coming off the sea. And I remember talking to someone at work. I was like, God, I've never seen fog like it. And she was like, what are you talking about? You must get fog like this all the time in London. I was like, I don't live in the 50s, like. I'm not Victorian London. Jack the Ripper and Sherlock Holmes. And
yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The buildings as well in this, you know, they're all black, aren't they?
Yeah.
St. Paul's is black, just for all the soots and... I mean, what a difference, London, half a century on.
Well, I suppose a bit more, you know, like 60 years on, I suppose 50, just over 50 years. Yeah, it really is, isn't it? How much... What will it be like in 50 years from now?
Well, we'll be living in bubble cars.
But going back to the bit where they kind of... Well, I say he seduces, but he doesn't really. They kind of just
badges her into having sex with him, basically.
Well, it is what I found, actually, when I saw it. I was quite surprised about how sort of open it was about sex and the fact that she kind of can look after herself and she's not... It's not like she's not painted as someone... It's not painted as a bad thing or a wrong thing for her to have premarital sex with just a guy she's just met.
Yeah.
It's seen as something like... She's a bit like wary of it, but then he sort of charms her and the situation sort of brings them together almost.
Yeah, it's interesting that. I mean, what a difference. I mean, if you watch something like Brief Encounter, what an amazing difference it is between that film and this.
Yeah, everyone's being terribly British.
British. I can't possibly sleep with you. I have a husband.
Whereas this is very, I don't know if it's just the fact the 60s have kicked in, and the sexual revolution is just around the corner, but even now, there is a lot of films tend to show, the kind of Scream, show the cliche of the, if a song has sex, they immediately get killed.
Yeah.
It's still, there is a certain kind of negativity towards sexuality, especially in American films.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to see that, you think the 50, like, really, 1961 was the fag end of the 50s. You know, attitude's very, oh, everyone's uptight and awkward. But they seem quite just like us. Yeah, you know? Yeah, quite a sort of, the attitude doesn't seem that different to now.
No, yeah, I agree with you there. I would say that that particular scene just went on for far too long.
Yeah.
Went
yeah.
on forever. By the end, I was like, come on.
The one thing I thought, God, it does feel like when when you are trying to convince a woman.
Exactly. It's just, it's turned into pleading now. It's basically,
you're embarrassing yourself, Pete. Exactly. Come on. Jesus. But then again, they sort
of... Just put it down for a second.
He sort of... Like, they sort of, funny enough, they do draw attention to that, don't they? They do sort of say, like, and he... The only way he kind of it works is that they get that phone call and he's sort of brought back into the brought back into the bedroom.
He does eventually give in. His his libido subsides for a few minutes, a few brief minutes.
He's all man, but oh, she's lovely in that sequence, isn't she? She's like with a little cute wet hair and you know.
Interesting use of reference to homosexuality.
Yeah,
I
sort of
caught
that.
As well.
Yeah, it's just like you look. She goes, "Oh, he says, oh, you look boyish." He's like, "Yeah, well, that doesn't matter." Yeah, well, that, well, I thought you, and something like,
"Don't forget you're normal," or something.
Yeah, well, but
she's implying that heterosexuality is normal.
Yeah,
and that if she looks like a boy, then she can't. It's all a bit weird.
She does sort of say. She says it in a very knowing way, though, doesn't she?
Oh, yeah.
It's not like, I thought you said you were not. It's like, yeah, hey, you're supposed to be the normal one or something like that.
Yeah, something
like
that. Interesting. You never heard that turn of phrase anymore,
no,
do you?
No, well, yeah. There's still a degree of normative, I think it's the term, where heterosexuality is considered the normal, it's this kind of the standard type, and then... Even if you have gay characters, they're either depicted as, they tend to either have issues or problems, or they're not that happy or anything like that. And heterosexuality is the kind of default, whereas gay, even if it's supposed to be, we're fine with people being gay, it's still seen as unnormal. It's not the standard. But,
yeah, I guess so.
That's a bigger debate for another day.
Yeah, got a bit of a way to go on that one.
But yeah, again, a reference to homosexuality in a 1961 film.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite... Anyway, there you go. But yeah, so, British Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Pipe
smoking and air traffic control. We have to mention that.
Everyone
stood around.
A lot of people were smoking pipes in it. That's great. And it, all the great the air traffic control. Someone smoking a pipe. Another guy there got a cup of tea and cup and saucer as well.
Yeah, exactly. 80 yards visibility.
Yeah. And what made me laugh was, London Airport, which was what Heathrow was called back then. Mm. And they just said, apparently London Airport's in chaos. And Leo McKern's character goes, some things don't change. And even then, there must have been, 10 flights a day or something. Even then, it was considered a chaotic place. Certain things just never change, do they? But yeah, it reminded me... in a way of Children of Men.
Yes. I can definitely see the
obviously
the
very different plots and very, but showing a Britain which is declining due to a kind of apocalyptic event of people sort of kind of just, like you can sort of see yourselves in there, but you still see how people are reacting. You can imagine how people are acting.
Well, both films very much represent the apocalypse in the background.
Yeah.
In the background of people's lives. So in Children of Men, the main character, the concern is with, with his circle of friends. And then in the background, something's happened. We don't really know what it is until about halfway through.
Yeah, yeah.
But, in a similar way, I love the way in this film the headlines kind of reflect the country's mood. And some of those headlines you totally get today. There's nothing's changed.
Yeah.
Britain swelters under
heat
wave.
Yeah, what a scorcher and a picture of a girl in a bikini.
Exactly.
That's the sort of standard every single... And also, they must... I'm sure it says on there something like, Brighton hotter than Spain.
That's the standard headline. There's a heat wave, it's... Hey, is Britain hotter than Spain? That's all we care about. Is Britain hotter than Spain?
It's just that feeling of anyone at home just wants to be able to say, glad I didn't spend all that money to go to Spain. Yeah.
That's totally it.
Those attitudes, it's funny, isn't it? Yeah, in so many ways, this country is so different to the Britain of that time. Yet in other ways, that attitude or those headlines, exactly the same. What I also like is all the, you know, you've got the main headline, then underneath you see all the kind of like smaller headlines. And they're always kind of like, again, very typically kind of British sort of silly, or no, not silly, but domestic, you know, painfully domestic headline. Now, you know, world tilts on his axis, and then underneath it will say something like, cabinet secretary resigns in, or kind of mundane, dull stories. You know,
they're very well put together, those front pages. They're really meticulously done.
Well, I imagine the Daily Express was heavily involved in the whole thing.
Well, the free publicity that got out of it. Yeah,
I mean, as I said earlier, it does make you slightly depressed about the state of the newspaper industry today. Yeah, especially the Daily Express.
Well,
it was depicted there as this, like, you know, like slightly tabloidy, but still getting the facts. You know, get the main story. This is important information. Breaking massive stories, and now it's stuff about immigrants and Princess Diana and
spin. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it's just.
British newspapers locked into terminal decline. You heard it here first.
Wow, people are like, what? They've never heard such a thing stated before. If they made a remake, I guess they'd have to set it in probably a TV newsroom.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like the it's really like the romance of newspaper journalism, the ink under the fingernails, the tightrest, the banter in the office. That just doesn't happen anymore, does it? It's people hacking into each other's phones. I mean, one interesting thing, I guess, this film, I suppose, bizarrely, I guess at the time it was made, what people would have really hooked onto was the detonation of the nuclear weapons, and that people would have been worried about, nuclear testing and the arms race and the Cold War. Whereas now, that's obviously not something we particularly worry about as much anymore. And now it's actually...
Yeah, we don't worry about nuclear war. We worry about terrorists kind of getting hold of nuclear bombs.
Yeah, that's something different. But now, of course, the big worry, the big concern is global warming.
Yeah.
And in a weird way now, this film, even though obviously the causes of global warming are totally different in the film, but now we kind of sort of see, you can sort of see it, like, that it's now a sort of almost predictive of what global warming is going to be like. So ice caps melting, flooding, weird weather, government's not really really struggling to get a grip on it. That certainly, every time I now read about the film, it always references global warming. And it's funny how, a film before, 61, no, I don't think anyone even really considered the kind of climate change of that nature, of human impact.
Well, no, I disagree. I think, certainly in the 70s, they were worried about a second ice age.
Yeah, I know, but in climatologists, there were climatologists at the time who did, sort of, who were my suggestions, but I guess the mainstreamers, it wouldn't have been considered back then, amongst, I suppose, pop science, would you say?
When was The Drowned World written by J.G. Ballard? Because that dealt with global warming
and
Britain flooding because of melting ice caps.
Oh, really?
I think that was this. Oh, I don't know when it was written now.
Yeah.
Write in and tell us, when was The Drowned World written? I think it was bubbling around there somewhere, but you're right, nuclear kind of war was definitely at the top of the agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I know in the 70s there was a big thing about starvation and not being able to feed people. That became a massive concern. And then it was the various food revolutions that happened sort of in the late 70s and 80s that kind of prevented that from happening. And we carried on, managed to feed ourselves. But yeah, and certainly I think it has an impact now in terms of global, just like the bit where they sort of realise that they're going to have public bathing units in parks because no public water's become so scarce.
Yeah.
And
I love the fact that all around the world, people are in chaos, you know, rioting or whatever, and it cuts to Britain. Everyone's queuing for water in Hyde Park.
Yeah, I thought that's true. I think that would happen now, wouldn't it?
I've got to say, the Germans have been particularly wasteful using water cannons against their protesters.
Well, that was quite early on, wasn't it? That was before it was getting bad. So.
Talk about shooting yourself in the foot.
Oh no! What's gonna kill me? So, would you recommend this film then?
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, I was very impressed with it, to be honest. It wasn't at all what I was expecting. It was more intelligent, fast, really interesting film. And not anything. There's not really much else like it in terms of the apocalypse genre, certainly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely. Heartily, two thumbs up from Lewis.
Good, excellent. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, obviously, it as I say, it's one of my favourite films, so I'm very much glad to hear that. And you should definitely watch it, those at home.
Yes.
It's very good. Very good. We haven't got any... I've got a great idea for a movie or ukulele challenge this day, because we have been up against it.
Blimey, we've been up against it.
Like you wouldn't believe. So I'm sure we'll have to have a double whammy next time.
Don't say that. They might not download the next one.
That's the ratings hitting the floor. So if you do have any non-black and white science fiction films you'd like us to watch, please do recommend them at the usual address, which is 101 films
you should have seen at gmail.com.
And I just can't get used to saying that. And obviously check us out on the blog,
which is 101films.wordpress.com,
and from there you can find links to us on Twitter and Facebook,
yes, and our various other things.
Online presences.
Bits.
Online
bits and bobs.
Yeah. You can get a whole package of Ian and Lewis material.
Matron.
We'll speak to you, or you'll hear from us next week. speak to you next week. Bye! Yeah.
We'll be calling each one of you individually next week.
Well, that's easily done. Bye!
Bye! I checked. We had.
Don't be. That's gauche to what? Say how what that rating is.
We're quite good. Oh, we're doing all right.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
gauche. I've never been called gauche before in my life.
Wait a second, dear listener. Just know you are not alone.
Exactly. There's two of you now.